Good afternoon, everyone. Schreiner's leaving, but we're going to get started. Not sure where he's going. I see. He's doing a meet and greet. He must be running for something. I wasn't aware of that. This is the 2022 installment of the Supreme Court review of bankruptcy cases by Frank DeCastri and Tom Schreiner. They're going to be covering, let me think about this, the 2021 October term, right? Yes.
Correct.
Decision. And then the Supreme Court has taken a couple of bankruptcy cases. We'll see if they both survive. They don't get digged. Maybe we'll hear about that. At least one of them. That's the 2022 October term. So that's enough of that. You guys know Frank and Tom.
They haven't granted cert on anything else, so that may be all we have to talk about next year.
Yeah, but then you have some Seventh Circuit stuff if you get to it, right?
A little bit.
All right.
A different program.
Well, we always talk about what we talked about before. You know, that stretches it out and we can pull it.
All right, so I'm going to pass the microphone to Schreiner so that he uses it so that people that are from a remote location will be able to hear him.
All right, onward. The hell with the people in a remote location. Let them show up next year. I don't like not having people I can look at and intimidate.
And I thought I was a curmudgeon.
Frank's done all the work, as usual, and so I'll let him lead off and tell you what we're going to talk about.
Sure. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming. I'm supposed to give a little plug here for the Eastern District of Wisconsin Bar Association. Jerry Kirkman and Ben Payne chair the bankruptcy committee, and today they brought us some cookies. So yet another reason to show up in person next time. Future events may bring back some more food. So they're proud to co-sponsor the event, and I think we'll be involved hopefully going forward with this program. Today, as Judge Helfinger and Tom mentioned, we're talking about one case that was decided in the last term and two cases that were argued just last week in this term. And the case from last term, very unique in the sense that it addresses the bankruptcy clause in the United States Constitution. And then this term, they've got a Section 523 non-dischargeability case before the court and a Section 363M case dealing with the jurisdictionality, if that's a word, of Section 363M. We'll start by talking, as we usually do, about the case that was decided. I'm going to try to go through this pretty quickly because those of you who are regulars will remember that we talked about this when it was before the court last year, and it obviously was decided between last year's presentation and this one. So the issue here was whether the quarterly U.S. trustee fee increase in what was called the Bankruptcy Judgeship Act of 2017, which we're calling the 2017 amendment, whether that violated the bankruptcy clause's uniformity requirement.
It's quite a kick to be able to practice in an area that has its own clause in the Constitution, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
not very often cited,
right.
But
patents and trademarks and bankruptcy, right?
Interestingly, there was a decision by, there was a case that was before Judge Fury. I believe Justin Mertz was representing the debtor in that case, that he did raise the issue, the same constitutionality issue, but I believe, Jerry, maybe you remember this, I think it was found that he raised it too late or it was waived or something like that. So the issue has been raised here in Wisconsin. I don't remember if Judge Fury issued a decision on it or not, but in any event, this case comes out of the Circuit City bankruptcy, a very large Chapter 11 case that was filed in the Eastern District of Virginia all the way back in 2008. So real quickly, the bankruptcy clause, which is found in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 4, not to be confused with the broader uniformity clause, which is in the same section, but in Clause 1, that deals with taxes, and that ends up being addressed by some of the courts that along the way here. Congress shall have the power to establish uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States. And what happened in 2017, the history on this is there were a number of years when large Chapter 11s weren't being filed. The number of bankruptcy Chapter 11s generally were down. And so the United States Trustee Fund was being depleted over the years. And so
it's funded out of some percentage of the disbursements made in the bankruptcy or in the Chapter 11, right?
Right. Funded by Chapter 11 debtors largely. And so less disbursements, less funds to work with. And so they came up with a solution to address that problem. And essentially it said, if the balance in the U.S. trustee fund as of September 30, the most recent full fiscal year, is less than $200 million, the quarterly fee will be the lesser of 1%. This is cases where disbursements are greater than $1 million, lesser of 1% or $250,000, which turns out is a pretty substantial increase in cases where you were going to hit the minimum threshold.
And that provision itself didn't have anything to do with the uniformity clause.
Correct. That's
right. The problem arises because way back when the code was adopted in 77, there were two powerful U.S. senators on the Judiciary Committee named Al Heflin and Sam Irwin from Alabama and North Carolina. And doing what senators often do, they protected what they thought to be the interests of their constituents. And they put a provision into the bankruptcy code which at that point contemplated the creation of U.S. trustees service going forward, to say that Alabama and North Carolina didn't have to play that game. They could do it their own way. That's where the non-uniformity came into it. Subsequently, the U.S. trustee program was brought in. We have it. Everybody around here that we know, Virginia has it, but Alabama and North Carolina don't, which is sort of how this problem arose. And it's still there, by the way. Congress didn't do that anything with that. I guess Alabama and South Carolina still count for something, huh? North Carolina, at least for some people. Anyway.
And as we'll see, the United States Supreme Court really, they left the two systems in place. All they did in their decision was address the different funding mechanisms in the two systems. So what you end up having on one side, the U.S. trustee side, you have the U.S. trustee program that is run by, supervised by the Executive Office of the United States Trustee. As we mentioned, that system is funded largely by Chapter 11 debtors through their quarterly disbursements, and that system is in place in 48 states. On the other side, you have a bankruptcy administrator program that is administered by the Judicial Conference of the United States. That is funded out of the judiciary's general budget. And that, as I understand it, that bankruptcy administrator program, there's a separate bankruptcy administrator in each of the districts in which this applies. So it's two states, Alabama and North Carolina?
Yeah, and six districts.
Six districts in those states. So that's the backdrop to all of this. In 1994, the Ninth Circuit holds that the lack of uniformity in charging quarterly U.S. trustee fees violates the uniformity provision of the bankruptcy clause. So Congress reacts to that, 28 U.S.C. section 1930A7, that allows the judicial conference to set fees in bankruptcy administrator districts that are equal to those in the U.S. trustee districts, and eventually the judicial conference does that. So then fast forward to the 2017 amendment. As I mentioned, it's designed to shore up the U.S. trustee program. But it only applies to U.S. trustee districts. Some 9 months after the 2017 amendment takes effect, judicial conference applies those increased fees to the bankruptcy administrator district, but only to cases that were filed on or after October 1, 2018. So if you sum it all up, you've got 9 months there where debtors in the U.S. trustee districts are paying substantially higher quarterly fees than those in the bankruptcy administrator districts. And the higher U.S. trustee fees apply to cases filed both before and after the date of enactment because it's based on when disbursements were made. In contrast, in the bankruptcy administrator districts, you've got the change applied only to cases filed after the effective date of the change in the law.
So you literally have a situation where a Circuit City that was filed when 2006 or something like that, still hanging around in Virginia, is affected by this increase, and an identical case filed in one of the two administrative districts, two states administrative districts, would be still paying the old fees.
Right. And just to give you an idea of how substantial this could be, Circuit City paid $632,000 in the first three quarters of 2018 alone. That's after the 2017 amendment took effect, compared to $833,000 over the prior 7 years. So it was a huge difference in the fees. And originally they started paying those, but then the Western District of Texas had a case and declared that the 2017 amendment was unconstitutional on grounds that it violated the bankruptcy clause and was unconstitutionally retroactive. They ruled that the 2017 amendment was substantially prospective rather than retroactive. And of course, they felt that it violated the uniformity clause of the bankruptcy clause. It went on certified direct appeal to the Fourth Circuit. They affirmed in part, holding that the amendment is not unconstitutionally retroactive, but reversed in part, saying that it does not violate the bankruptcy clause or the uniformity clause. They sort of dismissed the uniformity clause argument out of hand, saying that only applies to taxes and U.S. trustee fees are not taxes. They do hold that the 2017 amendment is a substantive bankruptcy law. The parties were trying to draw a distinction between substantive bankruptcy law and administrative laws. So they found the bankruptcy clause applies. And what they ultimately ruled was that the bankruptcy clause only forbids arbitrary geographic differences. So there were cases that said that you can have a different result in different states based on the application of a uniform law. Congress can fashion legislation to resolve geographically isolated positions, or problems rather. What they essentially said is never mind the sort of admittedly arbitrary separate systems that we have here, the bankruptcy administrator system and the U.S. trustee system. There was a funding shortfall that only affected the U.S. trustee districts, and therefore that's not an arbitrary distinction. Congress could target that problem, and
even though it created it,
even though Congress had created the problem, and I don't think many people were arguing that the initial creation of two separate systems was anything but arbitrary. So you have a dissent by Judge Quattlebaum. He says, wait a minute, that the U.S. trustee program districts are the only underfunded districts. That's a consequence of Congress's having treated them differently in the first place, a decision that, again, was arbitrary and based purely on geography. So it comes to the Supreme Court, and Justice Sotomayor issued the decision for unanimous court, finding that the 2017 amendment is subject to the uniformity clause or requirement of the bankruptcy clause. Again, sort of dismissed out of hand the suggestion that there's a distinction between substantive and administrative bankruptcy laws, and then found that have violated the uniformity requirement, saying that the shortfall existed, just as Judge Credibon did, only because Congress itself had arbitrarily separated the districts into two separate systems with different cost funding mechanisms. So really, it was Congress's own artificial funding distinction that created the problem in the first place. We're not going to ignore that. This system violates the uniformity clause, and so it was remanded to the Fourth Circuit to determine an appropriate remedy, which I have to think would be the paying back of some fees. But I haven't followed it. I don't know if anybody else has.
Of course, that gets back to the question of how broad a decision can be. One could assume that Circuit City might be eligible for some kind of a refund, but I doubt very seriously that the Fourth Circuit will say all the money would get paid around the country and in the 48 other states has to be refunded back. And if they did, Congress would probably overrule it. I don't know. Anyway, that notion of sending it back to the Fourth Circuit to figure out what to do will appear in a case that was argued, as Frank said, last week. Both the cases we're going to talk about were argued last week, December 5th and December 6th in the Supreme Court. In terms, what do we do about this? We may find a problem here, but what do we do? And, you know, let's send it back to the lower courts and let them figure it out is often an option that the Supreme Court finds attractive. And I think that may be the case here. This is the Mall of America case. It grows out of the bankruptcy of Sears. Not Sears Roebuck itself, but Sears Holding Company, which I always thought was headquartered in Illinois. But somehow, by the magic of bankruptcy venue, this case ends up in the Southern District in New York. And of course, it affects the big mall in Minnesota, but who cares? What happened was that the Sears went into bankruptcy, you will recall, having not seen what was coming in the retail world, aggressively not seeing what was coming in the retail world. And it got a bankruptcy court order early on, approval to sell. And you can ask, but did it in fact get an approval to sell? But it got a 363B order to sell a substantial portion of its assets to a newly created entity, Transform Holdco. Why does that sound like something? Newco, Oldco, Holdco, of its assets. And the sale closed 3 days later, and the assets were, quote, conveyed to the buyer, whatever those assets were. Well, what they were, it seems to me, is the ability to make up your mind later on what you want to buy. Something that in the real world, which is not to say the bankruptcy world, in the real world, one might say prevents it from being a contract, right? But that's the way it worked. The bankruptcy judge approved it. And at that time, Sears, of course, had a lot of real estate, or had leasehold interests in a lot of real estate, in a lot of shopping centers and malls, and I suppose other places as well, probably including the old stores where the catalogs were manufactured or something. But one of the things they had was a three-floor space in the Mall of America shopping center, and that lease was not transferred in the 363B sale, but rather the asset purchase agreement between Sears Holding and Transform Hold Co. Contemplated that Sears and Transform would later on decide what they wanted to do and then come in and seek court approval to do something else, right? Which was the real meat of what would happen, either to assign one or more of the leases to Transform, including this mall lease. And nothing about the sale order or the asset purchase agreement was contingent on a successful assignment of any particular lease. Instead, the APA provided that leases could be rejected by Sears under 365 and acknowledged that the bankruptcy court might not approve a proposed assignment. So again, what is this 363B sale? What is being sold? It's a two-step process, they told the judge, and he bought it, and probably was true. because the Sears assets had to be sold quickly, or they were operating stores at the time. Hundreds of Sears stores would have been forced to close, thousands of employees terminated, or they care in Manhattan, I guess, terminated. Consequently, Transform said, we can't fully evaluate the economics of hundreds of store locations at this time. We'll buy them, we'll buy something, we'll buy an option to do something later on down the road, I guess. And they had to defer the lease assumption process to a later date. So months after the 363B sale was approved, Sears sought and obtained over the landlord's objection, that's MOAC, the Mall of America Corporation or something like that, bankruptcy court approval to assign the mall lease to Transform under 365. The landlord appealed to the district court in Manhattan and sought a stay pending appeal because it said it was concerned that Transform might argue on appeal that 363M precluded appellate review of the order. Now, 363M, you know, we've reprinted it for you on page 13 of the materials. If you didn't bring your code with you, as all good lawyers should at all times. What's it say? We all know this one. The reversal or modification on appeal of an authorization under 363B of a sale or lease of property does not affect the validity of a sale or lease under that authorization to an entity that purchased or leased such property in good faith. Remember that term in good faith. We'll talk about that later on in the program too. Whether or not the entity knew of the pendency of the appeal, unless the authorization and sale were stayed pending appeal. What's me out? You come, you buy something out of bankruptcy, you know there's a lot of mess there, you want to deal with it, so you get it approved and you go ahead and close the deal and, you know, let the landlord appeal. Maybe there's a remedy out there, but one of them can't be to set aside the sale. That's what the statute says. Congress passed it. That should count for something, right? Unless you get the stay. Well, the landlord asked for a stay. At the stay hearing, where are we here? Sought a stay pending appeal to the district court out of this concern that Transform might later argue that 363M precluded appellate review of the order. Why would it care about that? Well, there was some law out there, as they say, in the Second Circuit.
So wait, just to be clear.
Yeah.
The appeal is from the order granting the 363 sale?
No, it's from the denial of the motion to stay that sale pending appeal. Right?
Yeah, it's arises in connection with the 365 order, I believe.
Yeah, but what are the 363M only applies to 363.
Right.
By its terms, it only applies to the earlier sale approval, 363B, but that didn't mean anything until they got around to the point where they decided they really wanted this lease. So they come in to get the court's approval.
Somebody must have thought it meant something, and it wouldn't be a court order, but go ahead.
Well, you know, I'm not saying anything. You know, you tell me. You understand how bankruptcy judges think or not from day to day. So the bankruptcy court was concerned about that. And Transform rose to the occasion, told the bankruptcy judge that 363M didn't apply to the order or appeal.
These are not the droids you're looking for.
which arose from an assignment under 365, just what we were talking about, not from the underlying 363 approval. And they agree, and the lawyer agreed that Transform would not raise a 363M argument on appeal. The bankruptcy court says, I rely on these statements and I'll deny the stay, okay? Now, after full briefing on the merits of the appeal, the district court ruled in the landlord's favor. Why? It looked at 365 and it said, well, this doesn't comply with the shopping center provisions of 365, which we can all remember from the last time real estate collapsed and landlords and shopping centers went to Congress and talked to their buddies and got things done. because it said Transform didn't satisfy the 365 statutory requirement that the assignee, in this case, Transform, provide adequate assurance of future performance of the lessor. These are tougher than in non shopping center assignments. And the argument detailed in the footnote on page 14 was that Transform couldn't satisfy them because it was a non-retail entity. It wouldn't get to operate a store there, which is what the 365 provisions are all about for shopping centers. They didn't propose to occupy the premises. They're just going to sit there on the real estate and sublease space to future subtenants, which sure as hell doesn't sound like what 365's protections of shopping center owners had in mind. So after the full briefing, the district court ruled in the landlord's favor and said that the Transform didn't satisfy that statutory requirement. Transform immediately reversed course in a petition for rehearing to the district court, arguing for the first time that 363M did apply. Ignore what man behind the curtain, right? But it was a jurisdictional statute that wasn't subject to waiver, and that it deprived the district court of jurisdiction to hear the appeal. You can look at 363 again. If you see anything about jurisdiction in there, let me know. But that's what, as it turns out, that's how the Second Circuit had previously interpreted 363M, that it was jurisdictional. Just the district court said, I'm appalled by the Transform's conduct. It's a party before him, but he can't do anything about it because it's jurisdictional. And he says, with deep regret, I have to agree based on Second Circuit precedent that I don't have any jurisdiction anymore. Go away.
Condolence card.
Yeah. Look good on your coffin, right? The Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit affirmed, because it was bound by its own precedent, of course, found that, and here, one of these terms they throw around in 365 cases, that order was integral to the sale. Why? Because the contract said so. The language in both the sale and the assignment orders. But the Court of Appeals issued a stay pending cert review by the Supreme Court, which granted it. Now, here we are. The arguments made rely on the petitioner's part and the landlord's part, a case called Arbaugh from 2006. What's this have to do with bankruptcy? Well, nothing. It's a Title VII case. A Title VII case which has a requirement before you are subject to liability for unlawful employment practices that the employer employ more than 25 employees. This Y&H Corporation didn't, but it defended the action on the merits, lost it in front of a jury, subsequently, after all of that was done, said, well, wait a minute, we don't have 25 employees and we're not subject to Title VII and it's jurisdictional. The U.S. Supreme Court, in rejecting that, does it sound like sandbagging? It sound like what happened to Mall of America? Yeah, a lot.
Sounds like someone got the bright idea late. And
yeah, well, that's been known to happen. You know, sometimes you hire smarter counsel on appeal. It's been known to happen too, or at least they think they are. So you got a Supreme Court, they said, establish a bright line test in that Arbaugh case and in many others. They've been doing this now for about 25 years with respect to their old decisions that used to say things were jurisdictional when they didn't say anything about jurisdiction. The argument typically was that something about the substantive statute, not like Arbaugh, which was just, we don't belong here in the first place, a stay pending appeal, it renders it moot. There's nothing there to argue about. If you can't grant that relief, there's no case of controversy, no Article III jurisdiction, and blah, blah. That's the line of argument. And of course, one always says jurisdictional issues are not subject to waiver. Well, don't believe that. They're not subject to waiver, estoppel, or forfeiture.
even in a situation like this one where Transform had explicitly disavowed any 363M argument, defeated a stay on that basis, and waited until it saw how things went on appeal, raising the issue only after it lost. This view of the Second Circuit was not was a minority position. Circuit split. Maybe we'll get a review on this, and we did. We note on the footnote on the bottom of page 15 the Seventh Circuit decision, which from 2019 in a case called Trinity A3 Development LLC. Where did they come up with these names? Versus Cole Finn Midwest Funding LLC. Overruling all their prior cases that called these things jurisdictional, and any other decision in this circuit that treats 363M as making a controversy moot rather than giving the purchaser or lessee a defense to a request to upset the sale or lease. We disapprove all of our decisions along those lines. And in fact, that's what the U.S. Supreme Court will end up doing here. The argument was that even if it were jurisdictional, it wouldn't extend to that's what I think the Supreme Court is going to do here. It wouldn't extend to the case or preclude the relief that the landlord sought on appeal because the order was entered under 365, not 363. And granting the landlord relief by vacating the lease assignment would not affect the validity of the earlier asset sale, even if the contract says it was integral. And so on. Transform makes a series of arguments. You can read them on page 16 of our outline, basically saying, "Nah, we win." As for sandbagging, well, we were mistaken when we said the 363M wouldn't apply, and 363M is jurisdictional. We always give you in these cases the arguments from the amici. I have come to realize that there are a lot of professors out there who make a good living writing or signing on to amicus briefs. And I don't know anybody listens to them because they're on both sides. They're as much whores as the rest of us. I take that back. No, I don't. The government, and it's
nobody's in the market for an amicus.
Right. Well, the Supreme Court has now removed the requirement that you have to get consent from the court to file an amicus brief. They said anybody who wants to file one can file one. And somebody I saw recently has suggested we ought to do that in the Seventh Circuit too. Well, why not? There's more money to be made out there, right? Good. We're all in favor of that. Posner, hated that. Posner would turn down requests, Judge Posner, I'm speaking of. Turned down requests for those briefs because he said, this won't help me. I know it all already. And this is just piling on, as often it is. Things that the page limits in the party's briefs made them reluctant to make. They would hire an amicus to come in and, that would be improper. But somehow or other get those arguments brought before the court another way. So at the oral argument, we give you a little bit of flavor of that on page 17. Justice Thomas, who always gets the first question, said, I've had enough of these jurisdiction issues. Others had similar things to say. Justice Sotomayor says she was totally confused by Transform's argument. Do you have anything to say about the question presented? Yeah, she asked. Gorsuch was deeply confused. Justice Barrett asked, why can't we just decide the jurisdictional question and send it back? I told you that would be coming up.
Because what was it focused on when she asked that question about, do you have anything to say about the question presented?
Yeah, there's a little bit of color on that.
Put yourself in the position of Transform's appellate argument in the Supreme Court of the United States. You're up here making a stinking argument.
Yeah.
One that they don't like.
And he knows it. The guy representing Transform is G. Eric Brunstad.
Oh, him.
He's
had a mixed bag of results in the U.S. Supreme Court.
I think he has.
He's been chastised a few times by this.
We had him speak at the annual bankruptcy seminar up in Kohler one year.
But in fairness, he has a bag of results, which is more than most.
Yeah, he does. It's a bag.
Well, if you do it enough, you'll get a few.
Interesting guy.
Connecticut or somewhere?
Yeah, with Deckard, the Deckard firm. I think he realized he needed to, you know, swing for the fences. And so the first argument he comes up with is, and citing some, there are some cases out there on that, including in the Seventh Circuit, he makes this argument that the petition is actually moot and the court has to dismiss it because bankruptcy court no longer had jurisdiction over the race, over the property, because it was transferred out of the Sears estate. And there's no avoidance action that can bring it back into the estate at this point. So effectively, there's no overturning the order isn't going to provide any relief to the landlord, and there's no case or controversy under Article 3. And so the oral argument just sort of it gets off track right away. I think he got everybody sort of riled up making this argument that, you know, that there's no jurisdiction, you got to dismiss the petition. And that's kind of the backdrop. That's why you had these justices saying, I'm totally confused, you're losing me here. And then you get somebody, you know, it was either Sotomayor or Kagan saying, do you have anything to say about what we're actually supposed to decide?
Yeah. Chief Justice made the point, which I think is a valid point, that this isn't moot because appellate courts can stretch it pretty far in finding the possibility of relief to justify holding jurisdiction. So let's say you can't overturn the order, but nevertheless, you can do something else. Maybe you can stop them, you know, anyway. So it's interesting that you mentioned earlier that Justice Sotomayor wrote Siegel last year, unanimous opinion. The speculation that I've read is that Justice Jackson, as the newbie this year, will get this one because this will be unanimous, and she'll also write a learned opinion and send it back to the lower courts to figure out what to do. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, if you can read the tea leaves at all on the oral argument, all the justices seem to be pretty uniform in their feeling that this is not a jurisdictional provision here.
I think they've crossed that bridge. I think, as I said, they've been doing for the last 15, 20 years, they've been pulling back all those statements that there's no jurisdiction. Rather saying, no, it really goes to a remedy or it goes to something else, but it's not jurisdiction. Who wants to be deprived of jurisdiction? We can't have any fun that way.
Yeah, and you had, you know, speaking of the amici, some of the law professors, you know, were raising a good point about bankruptcy practice in general with less plans of reorganization being confirmed, true reorganizations, more 363 sales, and more practitioners trying to use 363M, argue it's jurisdictional, you can't review this at all, effectively saying there's a lot of things happening in bankruptcy world out there that are not being reviewed on an appellate basis, and that's a problem. You know, we got to be careful here about what we're saying about jurisdiction when it comes to 363 sale orders.
Think about it in the context of this one. In a way, you could just see what Sears did here as taking advantage of that possibility and outsourcing everything, getting it out of the bankruptcy court by going in for a quick 363B approval, entering into a contract with somebody who, by the way, was a party to the proceeding, so it makes it less difficult for the court to say there's nothing that they could be bound by. Of course, they could be bound by whatever you say they're bound by. You know, it's sort of outsourcing everything that 365 was meant to do out of the bankruptcy court and let that get handled by private action after somebody figures out what they really want to do and how they can screw the landlords, right?
Yeah. And this whole two-step process, last thing I'll say about it, I understand it on one hand, you know, Sears, a lot of stores and maybe that, you know, there were other reasons why they couldn't just pick off a few leases at the time of sale, but you would think the Mall of America lease would be one they would know what they want to do with that.
Right.
And
if you don't do it this way, then, you know, some lender is going to have to come in and lay out its conditions for lending money. To carry them through this time. You do need to get through the time, but, you know, just to say, well, run into court, get the judge to bless it, and say, you know, we're free now. We can do whatever we want.
Yeah, but when you've got all kinds of real estate agents, they bring in national experts to decide which source
right.
the flow was in. And it's, I mean, I remember the boss, a huge thing with like all this analysis.
Perhaps
that was Jerry Kirkman showing sympathy for the for the poor debtor. Anyway,
and maybe the better explanation for it is Transform needed to figure out how it was going to get around the special provisions for shopping center leases when it was not intending to operate a store there.
Tell us about the other case.
Yep. This one is Barton Werfer versus Buckley, argued December 6th. This is the 523 case. Sorry,
we're talking about an individual case, not any big corporate shenanigans.
That's right.
Little individual shenanigans is that.
And involves section 523A2A. This is the provision which we've reproduced, page 7. Denies a discharge of any of an individual debtor from any debt that is for money, property, services, or an extension, renewal, or refinancing of credit to the extent obtained by false pretenses, actual fraud, and so on. So just to focus you on the statute a little bit here, note the terms individual debtor, right? So this is not something that applies to a corporate debtor. From any debt, and then the description after any debt really describes
the debt. It seems to grammatically.
Right. And that ends up being sort of the core of the fight here. The question presented is really whether an individual can be subject to liability for the fraud of another, even when they don't have any knowledge of the fraud or any intent. Simply by imputation of liability. And we'll get into the facts of this case. It involved essentially a flipping of an expensive piece of real estate in San Francisco.
It's all expensive out there.
Yes. David and Kate Barton Werfer. again, this one goes all the way back to 2008 when all the fun started. That's when they bought the home, and they bought it with the idea of substantially renovating it. And under California law, they were considered business partners. California law provides, I think, like a lot of other states, that each partner becomes the agent of the other. They share assets and liabilities, including liabilities for torts. And as long as one co-partner acts with the requisite fraudulent intent within the partnership scope, and a third party ends up relying on those misrepresentations to its detriment, then all partners are equally liable for the fraud without looking at whether each partner actually knew or had intent to commit fraud. So a jury found that Buckley, the purchaser of this home after it was remodeled, it had relied on misrepresentations about the state of the home. There were some things on the real estate form that were apparently left off, and there ended up being a 19-day trial, which, oddly enough, Chief Justice Roberts ended up commenting on at the oral argument, sort of commented that it seemed like almost said it was a waste of judicial resources. But so they have a jury trial. They find that the sellers failed to disclose material information, and award pretty substantial damages to the buyer. So then the sellers file jointly for bankruptcy protection under Chapter 7. Bankruptcy court found that the debts were not dischargeable. David had committed actual fraud, and that isn't in dispute anymore. And his fraud was imputed to Kate because there was this agency relationship.
Partnership.
BAP, the bankruptcy appellate panel out there in the Ninth Circuit, affirmed as to David's debt, non-dischargeable, but then vacated and remanded as to Kate's debt, and said that Kate's debt was dischargeable unless Kate knew or had reason to know of David's fraud. I don't really know where that comes from. I suspect it comes from some other judicial law. But you certainly don't see it in the statute, so it becomes a primary point of contention. So it goes back on remand. Bankruptcy court holds a trial solely on that issue. Did Kate have know or have reason to know of David's fraud? Finds that standard unmet and says Kate's debt is dischargeable. And then back on appeal again, the BAP affirms. Up to the Ninth Circuit. Ninth Circuit does it a little differently. They rely on an 1885 decision in the United States Supreme Court, Strang versus Bradner, that discussed partnership principles and essentially said, a partner can't escape liability on grounds that another partner's misrepresentations were made without the other's knowledge, and reverses and said that Kate's debt is non-dischargeable whether or not she knew the fraud. Now, I actually looked quickly at Strang versus Bradner. It was interesting. Their discussion of partnership principles, they did cite state law. They cited state law from a bunch of different states. So it was almost like they were sort of generally citing, here's what partnership law generally provides, and that formed the basis for their decision.
This was Justice Harlan who did something else besides dissent in Plessy versus Ferguson, if you want to remember that for future reference, Strang versus Brennan.
So Kate seeks certiorari.
But that is apparently what never did. It's amazing if you read it, I printed some of these off because in the old days, the Supreme Court could issue decisions that long and leave something that we have to deal with 130 years later. Fact is that, it's a the statute of 1867, we kept having short-term bankruptcy statutes in the 19th century. But the statute looks a hell of a lot like 523A. It didn't change much at all. So it really is precedential and it does hold, but, the fact of partnership is enough to bind the partner to determination that the other partner committed fraud and we're stuck with it. So they'll have to overrule. I'm sure they won't have any trouble doing that. But if they want to go with helping the wife here, they're going to have to overrule whatever.
Yep.
I think
you can extend that to LLC. Yeah.
Members are bound by the torts of the other members, aren't they?
I don't know what state law provides on that.
I think pretty generally it's like partnership law or something like that.
Well, for jurisdiction, it's just like partnership law. And that's why I was wondering if it's very old. Just, I can understand if you've got a number of managers.
Yeah.
LLC, but there's a manager.
Yeah. Well, they're not shareholders, so they don't get that immunity. I think they're probably on the hook for members, but I don't know. It doesn't matter. They're going to overrule it anyway.
So it turns out there's a circuit conflict over the new or should have known rule, and that's what how Kate is successful in going to the Supreme Court. So Kate argues, you see a lot of reference to policy and, fresh start and bankruptcy, and that's essentially what she says. So, bankruptcy offers a fresh start to honest debtors. Kate didn't know, that's their whole argument. Discharge exceptions are limited to those that are plainly expressed. And there's nothing in 523A2A that plainly holds individual debtors are responsible for their partner's fraud. They go through this analysis, their briefs, I don't think were very good. They kind of go through a lengthy recitation of different subsections of 523 saying, look, this kind of all focuses on the individual debtor.
A lot of professors writing amicus briefs here on both sides.
Yep. Their interpretation aligns with the code's policy of relieving honest but unfortunate debtors. Here too, it seems like they understand from just a statutory interpretation perspective, they have a problem with the way that the language is drafted. There's this passive voice formulation, obtained by fraud. They're saying that doesn't render the actor irrelevant. The modern code is debtor friendly. That was one of my favorite arguments. They say Strang crafted a federal common law rule And they say judicial lawmaking was abrogated by Erie. And they say that there are other circuits that reject the Ninth Circuit's view, including
Sullivan versus Glenn.
Yeah, this another Seventh Circuit.
Another punchy opinion by former Judge Posner.
Yeah.
Which is full of common law, and this is the way it is, and not a hell of a lot of legal authority, which says the innocent partner gets off.
Yeah, yeah. And sort of fascinating sentence in here, two sentences. In that case, Posner said Sullivan's debt, not the debtor theory, in other words, the theory that the statute focuses on the debt and not who the debtor is.
Because that's what the statute says.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. It is consistent with the language of the fraud exception to discharge. But this just illustrates the limitations of literal interpretation of statutory language.
Good old Judge Poker.
Okay.
What year was that?
That was
2015.
Yeah. So, there's some support for the petitioner's argument. And then you got Buckley that comes back and the buyer and says, wait a minute, this statute describes the debt. It doesn't describe who the debtor is, covers any and all debts that meet the criteria. The statute asks only whether money or property was obtained by actual fraud and whether the debtor's liability arises from that. And it doesn't limit it to just fraud of the debtor. They say Strang confirms the result. Interestingly, they argue the petitioner abandoned that knew or should have known rule, which is what they used to invoke certiorari in the first place, based on a circuit conflict.
A little dangerous.
They now argue.
Got you to the court, right?
Yeah, they now argue that knowledge is irrelevant. And 523A2A doesn't apply if the individual debtor lacks any fraudulent intent herself or does not commit the fraud herself. And so, of course, Buckley saying sort of similar to the other case, she waived and forfeited that argument by failing to raise it below. Buckley has his own policy to cite. There's a policy to protect victims of fraud. And that's why,
no doubt.
That's why Section 523 currently has 19 subsections in it for non-dischargeability. So they kind of walk through the history as well. We go through some of the amici arguments here as well. You got the National Consumer Bankruptcy Rights Center saying this rule threatens devastating consequences for innocent domestic partners, particularly victims of domestic violence. And so on and so forth. Interestingly, the United States here filed a brief supporting the creditor, which I found interesting.
I found interesting were the comments you begin there on page, whatever it is of it.
12.
12. Justice Thomas and Justice Kagan both say, wow, this sounds like bad policy, but the statute says the other way. How do we get around that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Justice Jackson, how does the petitioner get away from principles of vicarious liability? Chief Justice Roberts, why did the trial last 19 days? Kavanaugh.
That's a lot of fraud going on. It takes a while.
The petitioner has an argument that I think is a loser here, too. You know, you got Kavanaugh saying the code leaves state law in place. Sort of a common theme in bankruptcy, right? The state law applies unless the code says otherwise. And petitioner says, oh no, you know, state law defines what the debt is, but doesn't define dischargeability. And of course the problem is the non-dischargeability statute seems to go back to state law.
What the debt is, yeah.
Even Barrett saying that the respondent has a good argument based on the text of the statute.
Is this the one you think they might dig, Judge? Well, you came in here saying, yeah. Maybe you had some secret.
Well, I thought you were talking about Brunstad's argument.
Because the reason it was there appears to have.
Yeah.
So you could explain that because I made only the.
No, that's one of the risks you take if you get the court to grant cert on a particular principle and you go up and file your briefs and abandon it. The court sometimes says, go away. We're sorry we did this. Dismissed as improvidently granted. And even our Wisconsin Supreme Court has discovered the dig and now does that once or twice a year. Why do we grant review on this? This is tough. I don't want to decide this one.
So those are our Supreme Court cases, and I think we've got time to talk about the Seventh Circuit case.
Go ahead.
This was set aside for an hour and a half, I think.
Was it?
Right. I believe so.
Carry on.
You get a credit and a half for sure.
Carry on.
Yeah.
Carry on.
What good does a half credit do?
If you need that, if you are a half shy, it does you a lot of credit.
You get a half shy. I'm going to go get a cookie while you talk about.
So this is an interesting case. And Jerry, were you involved in this?
Yeah, the Olsen twins.
Yes.
Somebody filed it. I know. And the secured lender got a plan and put forward. And in that case, basically the lender and the lender still lost. Going along.
Debtor often finds itself in that position, doesn't it?
Find what?
Often finds itself in that position. Secured lender to whom I've given a guarantee. What do you want me to do?
Exactly. So, yeah, they were really, we came, I know we came in midway because I was looking at my really it's like a remodel of a house. We got paid.
That's good. Yeah. So interesting case. These Olsons, these are the individual Olsons. But there was a business case that ended up being a pretty significant Chapter 128 receivership proceeding, Olson Brothers Mill, which is a case that went up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court and established some law in that space. So interesting case. I got involved in this well into its multi-year litigation history. In fact, it was shortly after Judge Ludwig had issued his opinion affirming the decision of the bankruptcy court by Judge Kelly. So it's another one that has hung around for a long time. Started back in 2007 when Country Visions Cooperative acquired a right of first refusal on a piece of property up in Ripon, Wisconsin, and they immediately recorded the right of first refusal.
They're trying to hide it, huh?
Yeah, they didn't try to hide it.
Who looks at the registry of deeds record?
Similar to a lot of these, it required the owner of the Ripon property to promptly notify Country Visions in writing of any bona fide third party offer to purchase. Had to include a copy of the offer and provide at least 15 days notice. And when that notice was tendered, the way these are interpreted under Wisconsin law, the notice essentially constitutes a written offer to the holder of the right to sell to the holder. And then the holder can either accept that offer or waive its rights. So in December 2010, the individual Olsons, who were then the current owners of the property, they filed Chapter 11 cases. In July 2011, as Jerry was describing, certain creditors of the debtors filed a plan that provided that this Ripon property was going to be sold free and clear of liens, claims, and encumbrances. And there was a confirmation hearing set in August. Facts get a little interesting here. No one disputed that Country Visions never got notice of the debtor's bankruptcy filing or any of the pleadings that were filed in it. In August, there was a woman from ADM Grain who sent an email to ADM. ADM was the purchaser here, Archer Daniels Midland Company, that there was a right of first refusal on the Ripon property and ADM took no action. So then Country Visions did learn that there was a sale of the Ripon property that was being considered. They had a solo practitioner, I think, representing them. And then at some point, my firm, the Reinhardt firm, got involved as well, but it was sort of shortly before the confirmation hearing. So the solo practitioner.
They must have discovered there was a lot of money involved, huh?
I would think so. So in August, and so this is August 19th, the confirmation hearing set for August 30th, this lawyer for Country Vision sends a letter to the debtors and the council saying, hey, we've got to write a first refusal and a demanded notice of any proposed sale. That was also sent to bankruptcy counsel for the debtors. August 23rd, now a week before the confirmation hearing, counsel for Country Vision speaks with counsel for the debtors. And there's a little
dispute. Actually, there's two debtor counsel.
Correct. Right.
He had one in another
way. Right. So what they said to each other was disputed.
Of course.
Neither the debtors or ADM provided any formal notice to Country Visions even after that phone call. So Country Visions.
On the schedule either, right?
Correct. They don't. They didn't appear, Country Visions didn't appear in the bankruptcy cases or attend the confirmation hearing. And on August 30th, the bankruptcy court, being blissfully unaware of the right of first refusal, enters the confirmation order without any notice to Country Visions.
Is that how Judge Kelly described yourself? Blissfully unaware?
Blissfully ignorant. And of course, it purported to sell free and clear. So the closing, I think, was going to take place that same day.
This was a 363B sale without a 365 twist in it, right?
Correct.
Okay.
That's right.
Just to get us back to what we were talking about earlier.
There may have been some leases that were assigned at the same time, but there was no two-step process, that's okay. For sure. So hours later, you know, right before the closing, the record also showed that counsel for the debtors sent a title policy to counsel for ADM, which of course disclosed the right of first refusal. It had been out there since its initiation. So nothing happens.
I don't tell the judge about it?
For a period of 4 years, nothing happens. ADM owns the property, carries on happily until they decide to sell it as part of a package deal. And Country Vision learns about it and contacts the lawyers for ADM saying, we've got a right of first refusal on the property. And
now you say.
Yeah.
Didn't they get cleared away?
So what happens next is really, really interesting. ADM was represented by Kirkland and Ellis, and there was another firm that was involved here too. They say, fine, we'll give you notice of the sale. But they changed the terms of the sale to make it look like there were two transactions, one for the Ripon property, price of $20 million, one for the rest of the assets, price of $5 million. So, of course, they're jacking up the price to make the right of first refusal less attractive, right?
It was a joint deal for everything for $25 million. Is that how it's
done? Correct. It was a package deal, and then they
break it out. But the part you want is really the valuable property.
Right? Yeah, right. It's $20 million. So Country Vision's cries BS. They say it's a sham, artificially inflated to hinder our right to purchase. They decline to meet the purchase price. ADM and its buyer proceed to close on the sale. Country Vision sues ADM in state court, seeking specific performance and the right of first refusal. There's a 2018 trial. State court finds in favor of Country Visions, holding that the $20 million offer was a sham at an arbitrarily inflated price. And the price was inflated for the purpose of preventing Country Visions from exercising its right of first refusal. Not a very good finding for ADM. So ADM says, well, we better try the bankruptcy court. and they go back to the bankruptcy court to reopen the case. And asked the bankruptcy court, Judge Kelly, to say, declare that the right of first refusal was extinguished in that 2011 sale. Meantime, state court litigation, while the federal cases are pending, proceeds to the Wisconsin Supreme Court and all the way back to the circuit court, largely on issues of how to value the property. There was some accounting testimony that was key, what assets should be included and what shouldn't be. Bankruptcy court finds,
but ADM wants that all to be go away, right?
Right.
All that state court crap to go away.
Right, because if they win in bankruptcy or in the federal system
under 363M,
correct?
Right.
That's right. Then it was truly a sale free and clear, and, you know, too late. So Judge Kelly,
how does it come back to the bankruptcy court?
They moved to reopen.
Moved to reopen the case.
I think this is the point where we're doing something else. What was thought?
Where he buries all his good thoughts.
Yeah, right. They, what did they do? Like a motion for reconsideration of the Judge Kelly's order.
It would be potentially just moved to vacate the order. Yeah, they moved like an injunction.
It was.
Yeah, they did. Oh, they moved for an injunction of some sort. Enforced the finality of the. Yeah, I don't know.
Why can't you vacate a confirmation? If Rule 60 applies, you could vacate it
for fraud. Forever.
Oh, even for fraud.
That's what there's limit on. Anyway, they did something and ended up back in bankruptcy court.
If it doesn't apply, then maybe
Judge Kelly said,
Yeah, she actually did a Rule 60 inquiry and found that Country Vision's right to due process were violated when the debtors purported to sell free and clear without notice to Country Vision's. And found that any actual notice, because of course ADM said, well, wait a minute, they knew about it. Look, they contacted us, they did all sorts of things. And she said, well, any of that notice was not sufficient. And also finds that ADM's not a bona fide purchaser because it had both actual and constructive notice of the right of first refusal. Constructive arising from the title search, it's there as a matter of record, and actual because people called them and emailed them and told them that this was out there.
And whether or not there's a their BFP is important. Why? 363M, I think, isn't it?
Right, right. And so
you only get that protection if you acted in good faith.
Correct. Right. So confirmation order is
void. But the confirmation order said it was in good faith.
I know.
Correct. There is a finding and there is in most 363 so orders.
One might find that curious.
Yeah, make it ahead of time. Yeah.
So
work here.
Judge Kelly finds confirmation order void to the extent that it purports to sell free and clear of the right of first refusal. Interestingly, it goes up to the district court on appeal and it sits for quite a long time. And I think this is about the time, this is before Judge Ludwig had been.
It was with another district judge.
Appointed.
Should remain nameless.
Correct. So in any event, it's more than a year later, perhaps more than that, might have been two or three.
This when the process known in the old days as walking the dogs occurred. This is what happens when you get a new judge. You walk all your dogs down the hall to the new judge.
Maybe the new judge whistled. With the pipe.
Yeah, those were rats. And this was a rat, too. They walked around.
So Judge Ludwig affirms, noting that with some pretty strong language, noting ADM had only itself to blame for the result, should have ensured compliance with the bankruptcy code and rules if it wanted to ensure it was taking clean title. You know, look at the title report. Anybody who's buying a real estate should look at the title report, right? And criticizes ADM for its stunning lack of candor with the bankruptcy court. So as on page 21 there, I list a bunch of issues that most of which were briefed that the Seventh Circuit might have addressed under these circumstances.
And it comes before a panel that includes Judge Easterbrook.
Yeah. And so as you can imagine, he doesn't see a need to address most of those issues. He says in his decision, which was issued earlier this year, the parties devoted a whole lot of time to whether Country Vision's knew enough to supply it with the notice that's required, but that's a constitutional question and statutory questions precede constitutional ones. So we're gonna look at the statute, and the statute talks about you gotta be good faith, a good faith purchaser under 363M. And if ADM didn't buy in good faith, they lose no matter what the constitution says about notice.
Particularly when they'll challenge the bankruptcy court's findings of fact. Bankruptcy and district court's findings of fact that they weren't in good faith, and they didn't.
So here it's clear, he said, the debtors proceed in bad faith. Strong language here. If anyone should be made to compensate Country Visions, it is the Olsons. And then the ultimate conclusion, it is impossible to disagree with the bankruptcy and district judges that someone who has both actual and constructive knowledge of a competing interest yet permits the sale to proceed without seeking the judge's assurance that the competing interest holder may be excluded from the proceedings is not acting in good faith. So they say, get out of federal court, have fun litigating in state court. I make a note here at the end. I think it's the second time the Seventh Circuit has made a passing comment that it's unlikely a right of first refusal can be ignored in a 363 sale. In other words, that you can sell free and clear.
It's an encumbrance, huh?
So it's been a while since I've read these decisions. There was a confirmation order confirming the plan that
blessed everything.
Did away that granted relief under or granted the sale under 363F, right? And time passed. Eventually, the case came back to the bankruptcy court, and the bankruptcy court vacated that order, right? Applying Rule 60 on her own accord.
She said she would reconsider the order. Yeah.
Well, years had passed. So the only way that under the rules I can come up with to do that, unless you can tell me that there's some other way, is Rule 60, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's what she did.
And the 1-year bar in Rule 60 doesn't apply where there's a jurisdictional problem, right?
Right,
Tom, say yes.
Right. I was doing when you tell me to.
Well, you should disagree if you think it's wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's right.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So then it goes to the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit says what?
They say not a good faith purchaser. Done.
Okay, but the confirmation order, right, the said that it was a good faith purchaser.
Yep. Correct. But Judge Kelly found, I believe, in her initial decision.
So, but how do you square the circle, then? In other words, if you don't reach the jurisdictional issue, how is relief granted under Rule 60?
You just do what you want to do in the Seventh Circuit.
Well, the poor guy down there defending the buyer may have thought that was a bridge too far. You can't do anything about this. Say that to Judge Easterbrook.
I think
you
ordered a big firm confirmation order about
days.
Yeah.
Finding everything
was
good.
Yeah.
Or is it just that like orders like that don't have the effect people think they have? I mean, one can't take the view that, I mean, on the one hand, you got an order that says it's a good thing for sure. On the other hand, I don't know, like, if that's not litigated, I don't.
I didn't set a sound. She didn't set aside the plan confirmation order.
What did she do so much of it as?
She just said it was void to the extent that it purported to sell free and clear.
What does that mean? There's an order, right? Like, what does it mean that the orders?
We'll carve that part out and say it's bad.
Right. Right. And it goes to the validity of sale question, right?
Yeah.
The 363M talks about you can't affect the validity of sale unless you get that stay. And so it does beg the question, if you just throw out the piece that says it's free and clear of the right of first refusal, is that affecting the validity of the sale?
So look, but in the non-bankruptcy world, right?
Right.
It strikes me as at least intuitively unusual to say that a district court would vacate an order for lack of jurisdiction, but say, but some of the order's okay. In fact, you know, I always, and maybe this is wrong thinking, but I always thought as vacating judgments is sort of a zero sum game. It was either vacated or it wasn't. Now you could vacate it and issue another order, I guess, that basically, you know, writes whatever it is that was, so let's say it's reconsidered or some part of it, you know, was based on misrepresented facts or facts that were wrong. And so either under Rule 59 or under Rule 56 or Rule 60, the order is vacated and then the new issue, the new order issues. But it's odd. It strikes me as odd, and maybe it shouldn't. Maybe this all makes perfect sense, and I'm the only one that has this reaction, that like part of an order could be vacated.
I don't know. Unlike some other people in this room, I wasn't involved in this case. I don't remember it all, but it seems to me that it is a procedural issue. It's a good question, Judge. Really good question. But it seems to me that when they came into Judge Kelly's court later, the focus was on, can this portion of the confirmation order be used to block further litigation in the state court? And essentially what she said is no. Can't rely on that aspect for this. They didn't ask her to undo the order. They just said, wasn't in good faith. And don't look to me for an excuse. Go defend your position in state court on other grounds. You're not going to get me to take it out of state court.
So I went back and just to look at what she relied on 60B4, that the judgment is void. And she did.
And
but that's still subject to a 1 year.
She did that inquiry largely.
I don't think it is.
Sua sponte, because the parties.
There's a whole different interesting procedural discussion about what it means for a judgment to be void. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, in any event, she did that. The parties really hadn't argued that. So it was kind of an interesting approach that she took.
I thought it was all about the party can't be bound by the order.
Yeah, but that's a constitutional issue.
That's the constitutional issue.
But that almost right. sounds like a request for like a declaration of the effect of the order, right?
Yeah, maybe.
And that might have been part of what Judge Ludwig commented on, was that the way they brought it up initially. I think he was in a footnote. He may have said something to that effect. Just an interesting observation here. I had another case down in the Southern District of Illinois bankruptcy case. It was a grocery store, and I was representing a pension fund. And they sold the grocery store assets to a buyer and had language in the sale order that purported to sell free and clear of all successor liability, which in the pension world is a big deal. We objected to that sale and argued that as a matter of law, you can't sell free and clear of successor liability. But this is a kind of an interesting drafting note. Practitioners let me say it this way. This begs the question, if I wanted to excise that portion of the order that said free and clear successor liability only, does that affect the validity of the sale? Do I need a stay before I can get that relief? People who draft these 363 sale orders, people like Jerry, have gotten smart about this, and they draft them in a way that says, I will only close if I get the exact order that I want, which has to include
A through Z,
including wiping out any successor liability. Does that affect the validity of the sale now that the contract is drafted that way? Because the buyer is going to walk if they don't get it.
Call their bluff. Is that usually what the court does, right?
Yeah.
We'll see. I'm not going to give you that. I don't have any authority to do
that. The judges used to be the one calling the bluff.
Right.
You're going to debtor.
Right.
What am I going to do?
Yeah.
No, we're not going to do it. Yeah. Okay. And yeah. The judge went up there. What the hell? I'm not going to do this.
Right. We remember those days. It wasn't just Judge Martin who used to do things like that.
As it turned out, we didn't get the stay pending appeal, and by that point it was clear the writing was on the wall, so we withdrew our appeal. But interesting question. Another thing that occurred to me is it's got to be, especially in a big case, it's a rare case where somebody is going to try to get that stay, it seems to me, because what's the bond going to be? Right? If you've got a huge purchase price and the court says, fine, put up the purchase price.
$27 billion, yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to get that stay.
Right. Yeah, the U.S. trustee doesn't have to post a bond, right?
Yeah. So... That's it. That's what we got. Anything else?
Questions? How long did those Supreme Court arguments from this term last?
They've been going, what, over 2 hours in some of these cases?
Yeah.
We'll see how long that lasts.
The new way. We probably don't know about that.
Longer than normal, and
well, you used to come in and you had a certain amount of time to make your argument. And,
the Rehnquist days are over,
right? Yeah, I used to say about Chief Justice Hughes that he would stop a leader of the New York bar in mid syllable if the time ran out. He wanted to get to lunch.
Question. Question. I'm one of the sociopaths who is participating by Zoom. someone had asked about earlier on, one of the speakers mentioned whether there had been any subsequent rulings about the how to deal with the U.S. trustee decision. I just wanted to mention that I'm aware that the Tenth Circuit in August ruled in a bankruptcy case that the government has to refund to the debtor all the U.S. trustee fees that in excess of what it would have paid if it had been in a bankruptcy administration jurisdiction. That's John Q. Hammond's Fall 2006 LLC 15 F4 1011. It's the only one I'm aware of.
Where will the money come from? I guess Congress will just print some more, huh? The solution for the last few years.
Yes, it has.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and sort of not solving the U.S. trustee funds problems, right? Having to disgorge money.
Like anytime there's an imbalance, you could figure out a way to increase the other side of the ledger as opposed to decreasing.
Yeah, but we all know from doing creditors work, collecting from somebody who used to be your contract party is now and has got the money and you want to get it back is usually not successful. Okay. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. The question is, how does Transform argue with a straight face? I gather is really your question that the step two of the process by which leases are being assigned or not assigned is protected under 363 when it's really at that point a 365 transaction and no other. They're really arguing that they're linked. That there's language in the contract that says it's integral to the sale.
But that's really artificial, isn't it? Because that's what they do. I mean, that's what the lenders do, and it's what the buyers do and the sellers do. They basically say, boy, here's this thing that we think is magic, which I think they're about to find out isn't 363M, at least jurisdictional. And here's this thing we'd like to accomplish. And the only thing preventing us from using that is that the other one is under a different section of the code. So what do they do? We will link it.
Yeah.
We will link it in our contract. And we will say to the judge, you have to do it this way or we'll walk. And then we will argue that that magically means that you can't turn down the assignment or not approve the whatever without running into the same problems. I don't know.
And I think that they also, the definition of the acquired assets, I believe, also included sort of whatever ends up being designated as an assigned lease. That's part of the acquired assets. So it's all, you see, it's all
that
one.
Still, it seems like it leaves open the possibility that it's not
right.
I'm not screwing with your rights when I say.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, remember that Transform knew it probably wasn't going to win the assignment argument because they were never intending to operate a store there. Right.
At some point, somebody's got to call BS on these things, and this may be, if not the beginning, a step along
making that not as easy to do as some of those big law firms who draft these things think it is.
Did you get that from an amicus brief?
I could have. I got it from a professor, I'm sure. Anyway.
All right, thank you, everyone. That concludes this year's feedback. And there's cookies. Get a cookie.
And if they get digged, we won't have much of a program next year. Oh, thanks, Mike.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. Oh, birthday. 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 I just had one, too. Birthday. 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 Birthday.
No, I don't. No, it's nice to be up. My wife likes to be here too. Yeah, I have. Yeah. Yeah.